Hi, everybody, and welcome to Context Countdown. I'm Andrew Kripko, and I'll be going over five recent news stories that need to be placed in context. Some of them are misleading, while others are spot on. But either way, there's a context behind them, and I'm here to tell you what's really going on. Let's take a look at our top five countdown for the week. At number five, we have a Polish video game developer trying to profit off of the Kursk submarine tragedy 15 years after it sank. So, what had happened, guys, is a trailer came onto the internet, which presents this video game about the Kursk. They say it's going to be a first-person adventure-slash-survival game, and in this trailer, it shows the deaths of two of the sailors who had perished when the torpedo exploded. Well, in total, there were over 100 people that died during the tragedy, and the developers claim that they're showing this catastrophe from a new angle, but Russians are understandably incensed. They feel this is exploitative, inappropriate, and akin to making a video game about 9/11. Because the thing is that it's going to be a game, meaning that it has to be quote-unquote fun in order to sell. So how would you make an adventure survival game about a tragedy fun? I mean, do you recreate killings of crew members that probably didn't even happen? Do you implement some type of conspiratorial story into there? I mean, how do you make a game out of that? And this is what people are so upset about, because the family members of those sailors that perished, they're still alive. They're reading this. They're seeing this. They're watching the trailer, and it's filling them with disgust. But the thing is, unfortunately, the West will probably buy it. It might even become a hit in the West if it becomes created, because anything that's anti-Russian is a hit. Especially when it comes to video games. Guys, let me remind you about Call of Duty. Quite a few years ago, one of the Call of Duties came out, and they had an optional level called No Russian, quote-unquote, where, unfortunately, and disgustingly in my opinion, players had the option of machine-gunning civilians at an airport. I mean, this could never, ever happen with an American analog. I mean, this should never happen, period. But they had it, and the game sold millions. Then there was a World War II strategy game that had Soviet military units having to kill their own soldiers, and that game also sold. So this is yet another chapter in a long-running series of anti-Russian quote-unquote games that are supposed to present reality, but they don't. It's virtual reality. That's why it's a video game. And the bigger question comes down to, what is the limit? And if the U.S. is doing these things about Russia, well, are other countries going to do this about the U.S.? I mean, do two wrongs make a right? I mean, I don't think anything like that's going to come out in the U.S., a video game about 9/11 or, for example, Sandy Hook, a tragedy. But this is how Russians are perceiving this video game about the Kursk tragedy. And disgustingly, as I said, it probably will be released, and it might just be yet another notch in the belt of these anti-Russian quote-unquote games that will probably continue to be released, because we're in the middle of a new Cold War, and unfortunately, the U.S. is fighting a very dirty information battle, and its allies are doing this too, because this video game is created in Poland. The next one up is the confusion and speculation surrounding the Mistral helicopter carriers and what it says about their significance. So, earlier this week, a Russian official said the deal was scrapped and that both sides were just negotiating compensation. But Dmitry Rogozin, head of Russia's military and industrial complex, reprimanded him and said that's not the case at all. So, this begs the question, what's really going on? Guys, let me tell you the background about this real quickly. In 2011, Russia and France signed an agreement worth $1.7 billion for these two helicopter carriers. And at the time, the West was very concerned, but there was no official new Cold War, if you will, so they didn't expound too much pressure on France. But when this new Cold War started with the Ukrainian crisis, the West sent so much pressure against France, and unfortunately, the contract was suspended. Now, what France has done is it's shown the world that its business contracts are dependent on political considerations, and not just France's political considerations, because may I remind you, this was a deal between France and Russia, but the U.S.'s political considerations. And this is very, very bad for French business and the French reputation. So, going back to the present day, this Russian official, he was saying what many had actually suspected, that the deal was off and now it's just about the compensation going back to Russia. Now, that may be the case, but he actually broke protocol, if this is true, or he was spreading disinformation and speculation, if the report is false. But the reason that Mr. Rogozin felt so compelled to make a statement is that he wanted to do it for a couple reasons, and this is what I think. I think the first reason is, to clarify that the offer is still on the table, that no decision has been made on the Russian side to scrap the agreement. The ball is in France's court as it always has been. Second thing is, to preserve the confidentiality of negotiations. There could very well be some parallel negotiations going on about financial compensation in the event that the deal is scrapped, but those agreements should be confidential, and Russia also wants to leave an alternative open just in case France changes its mind, for whatever reason. And the third thing that I believe Mr. Rogozin was trying to express is the seriousness with which Russia takes the Mistral issue. This could have been a perfect example of East and West working together, but unfortunately, the West was pressuring another Western country to, instead of build bridges, destroy those bridges. And the big lesson here, guys, is that we shouldn't even be talking about the situation, if not for NATO, specifically American pressure on France, and its very, very weak and non-independent leadership. Because Charles de Gaulle, World War II hero, former leader of France, was known for being very independent, wanted to chart France's own course, and this was in the middle of the old Cold War. But Mr. de Gaulle would be disgusted at Mr. Hollande for the political games he is playing, and for bowing to American pressure to suspend the contract. Third in our countdown is Andrzej Duda's surprise victory in the Polish presidential runoff, which showed that Poles aren't as happy with the EU as the rest of Europe thinks they are. Guys, this was possibly the most surprising and exciting election to happen in Europe in the past couple years, because everybody thought that the incumbent, Bronisław Komorowski, was going to win. In fact, that's all the pundits were talking about, not just Polish pundits, but international pundits, but they were dead wrong. Which begs the question about why. Well, external observers, they had what is termed confirmation bias. They believe that Poland is a strong economy. This is what they saw, and this is what they heard, because that's what they wanted to believe. But the thing is that even when it came to the polls, in terms of the polling, I mean, the Polish people kept their true opinions to themselves. But I lived in Poland, actually. I lived for over a year in the summer of 2012 or 2013, and I saw that this economic miracle, it's frankly not true. I was living in Kraków in southern Poland, heartland of the Polish identity, and, you know, let me tell you guys some facts. 3 million Poles have left the country. 3 million. That's almost about 10% of the population, a little bit less than 10%. The economy is actually pretty weak, and unemployment is surging, especially among my age group, people that are between 18 and 30. And this economic growth, if you will, is due to transnational corporations, specifically German ones, that they're basically putting money through the Polish economy, but it's not tangible, real growth. It's growth on a spreadsheet, not growth on the ground. Poland, unfortunately, has turned into a type of factory, farm, and a source of migrant labor for the rest of Europe, but Poland's not seeing the benefits, and Poles are a very proud people. And if someone comes along, like Mr. Duda, and says that they're against this nonsense, Poles will behave very receptively, as we saw, and that's exactly what Duda did. He promised to protect Poland and the EU and not follow the German course, which is very important because Poles are very proud, as I mentioned, and there is some nationalism going on in Poland today that is not only anti-Russian, but anti-German to a degree. Also, what Mr. Duda said is he's going to lower the retirement age, which is very important because it was recently raised. He said that he'll lower taxes on small and medium enterprises, but increase taxes on foreign-owned banks and supermarkets, in what many Poles interpreted as going against German interest. And he also supported Swiss creditors. Now, the big question comes down to what happens in October with the parliamentary elections, because the president himself doesn't do much. Now everyone says that Duda and his Law and Justice Party that he represents will win, and I think that's what's going to happen. But let me remind you guys, this isn't that much of a change on the international scene, because both Duda and Komorowski both wanted permanent NATO bases in Poland, which would violate the Russian-NATO founding agreement and would create another crisis. So Duda shouldn't be interpreted as being, quote-unquote, good for Russia, bad for the West, as some people are making out to seem. But he will probably shift Poland's views towards Ukraine, because Poles are very proud, as I said. And this glorification of neo-Nazis and Nazis and Bandera and the genocide against over 100,000 Poles in what is today Western Ukraine, he's not going to be for it. He doesn't support this, and neither do Poles. So we can see a policy shift right there. Our runner-up is Japan's participation in forthcoming war games with the U.S. and Australia, demonstrating that an anti-China axis is definitely taking shape. So what's happening here is Japan's going to participate in the yearly Talisman Saber exercises off of the Australian coast. Traditionally, these are just between the U.S. and Australia. But the U.S., through its pivot to Asia, wants to bring in more countries and wants Japan to take a leading part in this anti-China coalition. So New Zealand and Japan are now taking part. So Japan's only going to send 40 officers and soldiers, which isn't significant. But guys, it's very, very symbolic because the U.S. is very serious about creating this China containment coalition and this new type of military architecture in the Asia Pacific. What it wants to do through these exercises, which are just going to be the first of many, and as we see, Japan was also partaking in military drills with the Philippines just a week or two ago, is it wants to increase the connectivity, working efficiency, and interoperability between its partners. The U.S. had also recently spoke about a regional and global role for Japan, and that's what we're seeing here. We're seeing Japan remilitarizing slowly but surely. This is all part of Prime Minister Shinzo Abe's vision to make Japan a great power again. But may I remind everyone, many states are hesitant about this because they remember quite well the atrocities that World War II era Japan unleashed throughout the region. But Abe has recently reinterpreted the Constitution, as he calls it, in Article 9, which is about permanent pacifism, in order to support the U.S. and its allies. The first step now, as we see, is going towards Australia. And as I mentioned, he recently had some drills with the Philippines. Japan is projected to be a key anti-Chinese state in the future because it's already running around and throwing its weight throughout the region. It's doing this through investment in Southeast Asia. Now it's adding another layer, which is military cooperation on top of its financial inroads. It also just hosted the Pacific Islands Forum just last week, which brought together a lot of Pacific Island states. The small states like Tonga and Fiji that are very small in population, but large in maritime area size. So what we have here is Japan and Australia becoming the lead from behind actors or anchors of the U.S.'s new security architecture. Why is this important? Is if one looks at the map from the Northern Pacific to the Southern Pacific, the U.S. is trying to lock in key allies that can counter China, can work together, and this is only going to create more friction with the Chinese, who are being increasingly assertive about their territorial claims. So there's this a triangle being formed, Japan, Australia, and the U.S. But I predict, guys, in the future it'll become more like a diamond. Japan, Australia, U.S., and India. Watch for that, because that's going to be coming really soon with Prime Minister Modi's Act East policy and how he's lately been linking up with the Japanese in Southeast Asia. But that'll be for a future program. At our top spot, we've got Turkey talking once more about a no-fly zone over Syria, having said that it already coordinated this with the Saudis and Qataris and are now trying to reach an agreement with the Americans. Guys, so far there's no official deal. But what's really important here is that Turkey and Saudi Arabia are talking, because before they were competing by supporting the militant groups in Syria, but now they're cooperating. We see this through the so-called Army of Conquest that they created. This is an alliance of Muslim Brotherhood, al-Nusra, al-Qaeda, bunch of bad guys, bunch of Wahhabis and Islamic fundamentalists that are very militant and violent. They behead people all the time. I termed it a new ISIL. But Turkey didn't invade Syria back in October when everyone thought they would have done so. Back when there was the Kobani or Ain al-Arab crisis, if you will, when ISIL was attacking the city and Kurds were fighting back against the Syrian Kurds. However, everything's changing now because now that the Saudis and Turks are talking, Turkey feels that now might be the time. Now might be the time for them to conventionally intervene in Syria because this is what NATO has wanted them to do for a long time. But let me give you guys some background. What Turkey wants is U.S. assurances and guarantees that it will support it, because any type of conventional intervention is going to be very, very difficult. Syrians will resist. Absolutely. And the fact that no deal has been reached so far is very significant in and of itself. This is what it means. It means that Turkey is still suspicious of the U.S. and thinks that while it's still talking with America, America might just be playing it like it plays all of its other allies, and it doesn't trust empty words. It's wary of being double-crossed. The same fears that it had back in October of Turkey goes in, does the work, U.S. doesn't support it. Let's just say they're able to successfully fulfill their regime change mission, which I think is horrible, but if they do that, then, all of a sudden, Saudis and Qataris, they get the piece of the pie. The Turks get nothing but a bunch of casualties and a bad reputation. The Turks don't want that. Well, the U.S. is hesitant about getting conventionally involved because, as I mentioned, it's going to be very, very difficult. And the U.S. doesn't want to get sucked into yet another war. Even though it wants to overthrow the democratically elected government of Bashar Assad, it doesn't want to do the work. It wants other people to do the work for it so it can reap the benefits. That's the whole nature of lead from behind. And third, the U.S. is being very vague in the promises and guarantees that it's providing to Turkey, and Turkey wants something concrete, which, for the reasons I mentioned, is going to be very, very difficult to get. But, as I said in the beginning of this segment, because Turkey and Saudi Arabia are now allied and are now working together in Syria, the situation could change at the flick of a dime. So watch out, because it's very, very dangerous. And right now, we end this week's episode of Context Countdown. I want to warmly thank you again for listening to my program, and I hope you'll tune in again next week. Take care. Bye.